Kyle Farmer.
And Kyle, where do you live and what kind of ranching do you do?
I do cattle ranching.
You're a cattle rancher, and where do you ranch?
In Potter Valley, California, along with Redwood Valley and the Navarro Ridge area.
I want you to talk about what are some of the challenges that ranchers and farmers face with fire.
So ranching, when your cattle are living in the hills, is an entirely different challenge, because you're not going to create this defensible space around them, because they are in this grassland ecology themselves. And we're choosing where they are. And we also, they're living in a grassland that is different than the perennial grassland that evolved successfully with the other species that also live up in these hills, you know, the oak trees and the madrone trees. And so the environment they're in terms of this incredible fuel load of annual grasses that came over from Europe, is an extremely dangerous place to be. We have a very strained, in terms of a global perspective, we have a very strange ecology here, where you have winter rains, you know, incredible growing season, sometimes short, sometimes longer. And then for what most of the rest of the world would call a horrific drought every summer. And so you get these annual grasses, this large amount of carbon that grows up and dies, sets seed, and then sits there either oxidizing. If there isn't a fire, it'll and it isn't grazed, it'll oxidize, sort of slowly burn, and the carbon will go back up into the atmosphere. Or it will be that carbon in those grass plants will be grazed by an ungulate that's able to then create a moist biological environment, whether it's a deer, whether it's an elk, whether it's a cow, goat, sheep. And in that case, it will that carbon will cycle biologically, return to the soil, and in a very interesting way sort of grow even more carbon the next year, because it will have created a more nutrient-rich environment for itself. And so it's this funny thing you're trying to do as a cattle rancher. You actually want to produce, you want to help the ecology produce as much biomass in terms of carbon as possible, because that's how you make your living, and that's how you're able to raise these animals. And yet the more biomass you create in this big burst in the spring, the better your soil is, the more, you know, then you're actually increasing the fire danger in a way. And so your challenge in any of these, the more variable your ecology that you're managing is, your challenge is varying your management to try to match the variations in the grassland production. And so that's the kind of irony, is you'll talk to people who sort of live lives where they aren't very kind of connected to the ecology that they depend on, and they say, oh, it was a great rain year, so that means there's not as much fire risk, because they have sort of, you know, it's a very it's this very logical correlation between wetness and fire. We think of them as opposites in a way, but there's this time variant too, right? You have lots of wetness and then it's always going to dry out. So we have these incredible forage years from a cow's perspective, from an elk's perspective, from a deer's perspective. It's this incredible forage year, and yet it's not like we have these connected landscapes where the elk then kind of might move over from the Central Valley, from the tule marshes of the Central Valley, and maybe take advantage of this abundance that's being produced. Or there weren't buffalo here, but there would have been at very specific times, at very specific climactic conditions. But we don't have those kind of mass migrations and mass movements that could take advantage of the abundance and then could either move away when it's not there, right? Mm-hmm. So instead, we have an incredible forage year, not nearly enough animals, and animal agriculture is an increasingly controversial topic, but I think we should all be able to agree that either an elk or a cow should somehow graze this grass, because the grass wants to be grazed. And in many cases, if the grass is grazed and the grass is shorter and there's less fuel load, the fire behaves much differently. And that's why fires that tend to start on ungrazed public land and move through ungrazed land And there was a really interesting study on this that I saw at a rangeland convention out in Stockton a few years ago. And I wish I could remember the scientist's name, but he used satellite imagery matching these APNs and was able to show almost 100% that it would start burning on ungrazed land. And it's not that it stops when it gets to the fence line when it comes on ungrazed land. It will. That means you overgrazed. And sometimes that actually is your goal. I overgrazed around my house on purpose. And not every plant species that lives near my house is in agreement with that choice I made. But my house is. So, but when it does move on to these shorter grasses, in many cases, if you do a good enough job, perennial grasses, that's when a firefighter with a hose might be able to actually stop it. Even a bulldozer isn't going to stop a fire moving through grassland if it's actually, once you have grass that's 4 feet tall, it actually creates spot fires is what the generalist statistics. And it's what's the moisture content, what's the humidity of that day, what's even the grass species. But when you get this really tall grass, it sort of sucks up and blows up and shoots across. And you just can't go in there to try to fight it. So this sort of really tall dead grass, I don't really view as a very natural phenomenon. It's a product of the species that have been brought in and the lack of ungulates of grazers of any type. And what's kind of fascinating, this isn't going to be included, I'm guessing, because it's just totally random, but I was talking to a botanist from the Pinnacles National Park, and she pointed out, it's something that's always kind of tried to figure out, is why did California not evolve more foxtails and wild oats? Like all these European species, you know, millions of years of evolution, why did these species not come to exist here? Rationally, it's like evolution tends to try a whole bunch of different things. This seems to be a really successful model. Why would evolution not have figured this out? Because it did figure out about four annual grass species that are pretty small. They don't create that kind of mass, biomass that the... And what it turns out, according to her idea, is a lot of these grasses, maybe 3 years is as long as they can survive their seeds. Your forbs, on the other hand, you know, you're talking 50 years, you know, hard seed-coated forbs. And so the only reason why we have all these invasive grasses is that we haven't reached one of these long enough droughts to kill them all off. And over sort of geological time, I mean, even non-geological time, over evolutionary time, over a couple hundred years, we'll probably have a mega drought that will just take out all of these species. And you'll return to species that can actually deal with that kind of conditions. Because in these variable climates, if you either can adapt and fluctuate and kind of go into some sort of estivus when there's not a lot of moisture, or you can easily imagine a weather event that would only have to last like 3 years, and all of a sudden all these sort of short-lived annual grasses just would be gone until some sort of other disturbance brought them back in, whether it was a human movement or a raft of logs, you know, from a big tsunami would kind of bring them across. So this sort of annual production of grassoline is something that we have to take seriously, you know. That's actually not the purpose of the mowers on the side of the road. Their job, their mandate, the money that pays for that is only to make it so you can see the street signs. So how to manage roadsides in fire ecologies is not something that is really anybody's job at this point. And yet the number of ignition points that we have, whether it's the houses that are placed, you kind of imagine if each little house is an ignition point, every single road that goes through becomes an ignition point. The what it will take to actually manage all of those different ignition points is quite spectacular. I mean, we talk about sometimes the wildland-urban interface. That's actually not the right term for a place like Mendocino. That would actually be the wildland-urban intermix. You know, we really are, a lot of us are living in the wildlands, right there in the middle of it. This isn't that fire coming down the hill into Malibu. that's the interface. But this intermix is an entirely different challenge. And really, the 100 feet around your house, to me, is to keep the forest safe from you. You know, when it comes to keeping yourself safe from the forest fire, you know, you're talking about fuel management on a scale larger than we are really wanting it to do with weed whackers. I mean, I don't think anybody loves going out with a weed whacker. But cattle and sheep and goats love going out and managing fuel. That's what they live for. And they can be managed well, they can be managed poorly. And a lot of times, we only know if they did a good job maybe a year later. And that's what's kind of fascinating is these disturbance ecologies. You can't judge them when the disturbance happens. You judge them by the ramifications of that disturbance. So you don't go in right after the fire and say, look at this, how terrible this was. I mean, if it makes it into somebody's house, you know, that is terrible. But from many of the other plants, many of the other species that we cohabitate with in these hills, they were happy about it. And it might look wrong from our vision of beauty, but a year later, it often doesn't. And it's been really interesting for me actually haying this year. And so each pass, I'm driving east one pass and looking at the burn from last year, and driving west the other pass and looking at our ranch that has burned in these small prescribed fires we've been doing, but it hasn't burned in terms of the whole ranch. And then another hay field, it was actually the opposite. I was driving west and seeing where it hasn't burned, and then driving east and seeing where it had burned. And really, in a weird way, as the day went on, I started really seeing the beauty even from a distance of that patchiness, and what had kind of looked like a scar started to kind of change in the way my mind saw it. And it started looking like, oh, you know, that actually might be beautiful. And if you can find, there's a book about the Sierra Nevadas where he found photo points from some of the earliest pictures that were taken, and then found photo points from later, early photo points where the Sierra Nevadas were still being burned by the native peoples. And man, it's beautiful. It's different, but it at first it almost looks like logged, you know, because it's now grown up so thick. But it's that patchy burn that then when it's a patchy burn, it's a small burn. I mean, even the October fires, when they wrapped around, when they came to our fence line and the bulldozer was able to build this big desert between the fire and the fuel. Also, there was a 1993 control burn on the other side of the fire line. And I think that's one of the reasons why that fire line held, is when, you know, if it's a windy day, if it's spot firing and it's landing, you know, it's not, if you're looking at a fire ecology around here, which I understand is about a 10-year fire return interval in the oak woodlands, you know, it's a much different place for a little spark to land. And that's what we don't know about. You know, there's never been a study where a drone sort of managed to follow each spark into the forest or something and saw where it landed. But I think that's the most fascinating thing, is all the sparks that don't burn. And that's what we have to start thinking about, is how do we create places that are still vibrant? We don't want to create a desert and call it peace, as they talk about in Agricolis. But we need to create a place that can thrive after fire. And that's how Hugh Safford talks about a restored ecosystem in California, is one that can burn and be okay. That's how you kind of should judge a successful ecological restoration project, is that it's kind of, which, you know, that's almost like how you could judge a successful personality, you know, if you can burn and be okay, right?
Kyle, tell us about what happened in 2017, just from the perspective of you on the ranch, and just kind of paint a picture of that time and what happened with the animals too, and you working as a volunteer firefighter.
Yeah, it's a very vivid night. And it kind of, one thing that shaped that night for me is that I had broken my back less than a year before, I guess 5 months before. So I had been resting. I hadn't been very much of a firefighter it wouldn't have been responsible to be on a fire line, even if I was still in recovery. But I did respond that night, and actually was fighting some small electrical fires that luckily stayed small, and watching, you know, the rest of the team do some amazing things in terms of protecting the penstock at Potter Valley, which was a big deal, and as well as many houses. So the fire, you know, started in Potter Valley, but shot right over the hill and actually swept down the hill on the other side with these 70-mile-an-hour winds onto a ranch where there were 45 cattle that in that initial sweep were caught up in the flames. And so after that first night, I was kind of patrolling for reignition in Potter Valley. And the next day we began the process of trying to get into Redwood Valley to go try to save those cows, because, you know, if they had been in better places, they could have survived the actual heat, and yet there was no food. All of the grass was now gone. So the ones that, and I think it's fascinating thinking about, you know, deer and elk and how they would respond, you know, in smaller fires, it's not a big deal. Are some of these massive fires natural, where the re-inhabitation process is, just from a simple geometry perspective, is so challenging? I just don't think they're natural. And so in many cases, the animals would be able to get away, but there was a fence. And that was one of the really sad things to see, was how many animals have been caught up in the fence. I mean, wild animals, as well as our domestic animals, as well as wild animals that just didn't make it out of the fire at all. I had a very interesting conversation with a coyote. You know, animals that you kind of had to decide if they were going to survive, or if the right thing to do is to help them stop suffering. So luckily, you know, the Farm Bureau was able to put together a list and get in touch with the Highway Patrol, and I'm not even sure how many other contacts they had to go through in order to make it so that we could get through these roadblocks. But it was pretty nerve-wracking leaving, because you weren't sure if you were going to be able to get back in past the roadblock. You know, there could be a shift change. So that's something that the Farm Bureau has been working on, is trying to kind of bring a level of kind of predictability for the next fire, which will come, so that, you know, they do need to have standards of crossing some of these roadblocks. There's a reason why the roadblocks are there. But in some cases, you know, the power might be out, there might not be water, you might be needing to get them food. That we're actually pretty well set up through volunteer networks to load a couple horses, to load maybe some chickens and find a place for them. But in terms of these kind of commercial operations, you're not going to necessarily bring in a whole bunch of semis and try to move them.
How many animals were on the ranch in October 2017?
There were about 50. Very, very few survived.
50 total?
Mm-hmm.
On the whole ranch?
On that lease. Okay. Yeah, on that.
So the ranch lost 45 cows that night?
Yes. And they were pregnant. They were pregnant, which was a sad thing. And they, not all of them were killed the first night. Some of them, I gathered them thinking I was saving them. And when the vet was able to actually examine them, he told me that it was not the right thing to do to try to save them, that they were suffering and were not going to make it. You know, it's sad to me, because they're firefighters. You know, I sometimes just picture them wearing fire helmets. They're out there picking up grass and turning it into compost right there up on the hill. If you really think about what it would take to do what they do, it would just be a hell of a job. I really think about it. You weed whacker, then you'd gather it up, then you'd put it in a wheelbarrow, then you'd carry it down the hill, then you'd compost it, then you'd bring it back up the hill, and then you'd scatter it. And that's what they're doing for us every single day. And they really make a difference. You know, that fire would have been different. That fire would have moved faster through that ranch. More, I mean, and then you're talking about a fire with even more superheated fuels headed up ahead of it as it came into Redwood Valley. I mean, it would have been a different fire if those cows had not been grazing that hill.
What hill was it, Kyle? What lease land?
Skull Mountain.
Where is that?
In Redwood Valley, in the off of East Road, towards the end of Redwood Valley.
So, what would be one thing that we could think of to better prepare for the next fire that is going to come, for even your ranch?
You know, the PG&E power shutoffs are kind of having us think about these things in terms of how dependent we can be on electricity to move water, for example. You know, hopefully we're not all just going to move to generators. We can do this with gravity. We can do this with solar. It's going to come. And I think that varying our stocking rates and really trying to be, I mean, that's the problem though, that a downslope wind event, I just don't think you ever prepare for a downslope wind event. You saw how differently the ranch fire burned. You know, in the ranch fire, we didn't have any cattle on the lease that burned during the ranch fire. It basically had too much grass, so we didn't have cattle on it. But it was a splotchier fire. It was a slower moving fire. It wasn't a big wind event fire. I mean, there's really not much you can do, I think, in a fire like that. If we had somehow been told within the first seconds of the fire starting and had already been in Redwood Valley and hadn't had to drive around, we would have had just enough time to get ourselves killed. So there's really nothing to be done. I think luckily with climate change, downslope wind event fires are going to become less likely, oddly. but that's other things will become more likely.
Can you talk a little bit about prescribed fire? How would you define them and why are they helpful? And why haven't we been doing them before?
We have definitely been doing them before. I can't really speak about the native practices of burning, but I've read a lot about it. I really hope that there is leadership there, because that's something that's really exciting. And it's happening with the Yurok tribes a little north of us are sort of demanding their rights to burn. And there's a lot of knowledge there. In our case, the management reasons why we light fires is not necessarily for these plants that other people are aware of. And yet those fires do help some of these important plants as well. The reason why we're lighting prescribed fires, and the reason why my father-in-law has been lighting prescribed fires his entire life, and that prescribed fire is the newest, sort of trendiest term for this. It used to be controlled burns. And I think a little bit of acknowledgement about, you know, once you light it, it's not really a controlled burn anymore. So the prescription concept is that there's a reason why there was planning behind it. In some cases, it might be a professional burn boss writing a prescription, and you're really thinking about what are your goals. And so in some cases, your goals might be shifting the plant species community. So some of these grasses that have moved in more recently, and you notice them because they kind of have this kind of lime green hue later in the season. They're called late phenol, and they're incredibly inedible, both to cattle and to other ungulates. And they found that, for example, Medusa head grass, which is just all over the place, is spreading at 12% of the year and makes the entire grassland 80% less available to the wildlife. And it's an interesting grass. It's very high in silica, so it doesn't rot. And it lasts and lasts and lasts. So when you go out to these places that haven't either been grazed or burned in a long time, what you often find is this sort of intricate mat of Medusa head grass. Sometimes if you dig underneath it, you'll find a beautiful grass that's a native grass called Danthonia californica, California oak grass. And that's the grass that really kind of carries the elk and the deer and the cattle later into the year, into the summer. It's very tolerant of grazing. It actually has seeds up in its stalk. So if it gets trampled, it reseeds itself with trampling, not just on the seed head, but actually inside of the stalk. It has maybe 3 seeds. It loves to burn too. I mean, all of these grasses love to burn. So it's kind of, you know, when you're managing something as large as a ranch or as large as a county, you can't really think about it in terms of what am I going to do to this plant and not do to this plant. What you're looking for is something that you can treat the whole ecosystem with, and then kind of know and hope, do your best that certain ones that should win, that you want to win, that you're kind of choosing this disturbance event based on who you think will win after the disturbance event. And it turns out that with fire, there's a lot of good winners, and we don't even really know who the winners are. And every year, every day, every time I get online and search Google Scholar, you find another study about all the benefits. There was recently one about, charcoal lasts thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That the carbon becomes pyrolyzed, I think is the word, and it just sticks around. I mean, maybe 100,000 years. It's a diamond in a way. And so each fire, if you picture this, each fire, some things turn into charcoal. That charcoal sticks around. Then another fire, a little more charcoal, regrows, a little more fire, and a little more charcoal. Meanwhile, that charcoal, as we've been learning about with biochar, with the Tierra Preta in the Amazon, it doesn't have as big a benefit in the temperate climates as it does in the tropics, but it still has a benefit in water holding capacity. I mean, as this charcoal over each fire gets integrated into the soil, it's actually sequestering an amazing amount of carbon. There was another study that managing for disturbance stabilizes forest carbon. So these regular fires where the trees survive the small fire means that you have older trees. If we don't have fire and you have a buildup of fuel and you have this buildup of these grasses that sort of also connect these different forests. So it might be that the fire starts in some grass next to the road, shoots up the hill, and is all of a sudden burning this forest. Managing to save those trees also has a huge impact on how much carbon is combusted back up into the atmosphere. So it's kind of counterintuitive. You could have a prescribed burn, and you burn an understory, and so you actually released carbon, and so it's, oh no, this is terrible, we shouldn't be doing this. But you're kind of assuming that there's not going to be a fire the next year. And it's this hope of sort of perfectibility is a lot of, I think, of what our sort of social challenges end up being about, is this like drive to somehow create this perfect ecosystem that's never going to be hurt or disturbed. And yet it's the disturbance that characterizes it. And so by having these fires move through more regularly, I mean, we're not talking every year. If we could get to the point where when you look out onto a mountain and you're looking at, let's say you're looking at 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres of mountain, and you're seeing all these little splotchy 200-acre burns, 100-acre burns, even 9-acre burns. You get down to a 9-acre burn and you're out of the air quality world. So that would be the ideal, right? Just lots of little burns. So when the next burn happens, the fire burns to that burn. And that's what we should be seeing is, oh, there was a little fire and it got into the other burn. And then either firefighters were able to put it out if it's endangering homes and lives, or we let it burn because it's not going to burn as intensely. And that's the thing, is there's this kind of push in another way to allow fire back into our forest, back into our ecosystems, in a sort of more ideologically wild way. But that if the fire started because somebody was, trying to mow with a metal blade in the middle, on a hot day, in a hot, dry, windy day, that's not a natural fire, and that's burning in a different way, and it's having a much different impact in these places than what I would consider a wild fire. So you get into these really fun, philosophical, twisty mind games trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. But I think in the end, the only thing to do is to do things and do them small enough that you can listen to what happened, and then to do a little bit better job, and then keep on doing it small, but just to stay in action about these things. And that's why we're starting this Mendocino Prescribed Burn Association.
Tell me a little bit about that.
So Lanya Quinn and Jeff Stackhouse up in Humboldt County have been sort of spearheading bringing the prescriber and association idea over from where it's sort of still surviving, these little endangered species of prescriber and associations that are thriving in other parts of the country. So Florida is really the leader of the prescribed burn world, but Oklahoma and Kansas, there's places where we're lighting millions of acres of burns a year. In Florida, I haven't been to see it. I would love to. That's one of the things that Lanier Quinn and Jeff Stackhouse have been able to do is travel and see some of these burn associations. And they're doing it, apparently in Florida, they're doing it in, you know, burning between the houses, burning in the suburbia, burning instead of a weed whacker, in a way. And you can get to that point. I mean, Florida is going to be different than us. And it's not going to happen overnight that we could get there.
Tell me about what it's going to look like here.
What's it going to look like here? So the first step is that we're every single fire shed is going to form into a fire safe council. And they're going to get in touch with Emil. And they're gonna start getting together as neighbors, and they're gonna use some of these fire modeling maps like Behave Plus, and somebody in the Ag Extension or something is gonna have to do this for them. But we should really understand where are these fires moving, and it's gonna have to be multiple people. It can't be kind of one, especially it can't be the busiest person per fire shed, which is often how it ends up trying to happen, right? So because fires tend to burn uphill. You know, they heat the fuel ahead of themselves. They burn uphill faster than they burn downhill. They burn uphill, they burn up saddles, they burn up draws. And when they get to the ridgeline, unless it's a weird day, they'll usually go out. And so if we think about all of these places as fire sheds, and we have the coordination to form these fire safe councils, which is what Emil is trying to do, what I imagine is those fire safe councils actually becoming almost like collaborative ranches. Because the large amount of annual European grass makes burning much different than it was before that grass was here. It's just a much different fire, as long as that grass is as prominent and as tall and as explosive as it is. And so I view one of the first things you have to do before you really can have prescribed fire in a lot of these places is have a certain amount of grazing. And we are going to be doing grazing a different way than it's happening in Sonoma County because we don't have as much money. So we're going to do it in a way that kind of trades that contract grazing, which people ask for the bids. And then what I have watched happen again and again is the bids come in too high. And a lot of the times that's because they're trying to graze a place that's so small that the mobilization and demobilization costs, the trucking them up here, getting them set up, trying to figure out which dogs they have to worry about in that area, and then getting the animals back out. Those costs and risks are so high that it just ends up not happening. People kind of get tuned in. They start trying to find a way to maybe manage some of the fuel around their area. But until they're able to collaborate on a scale that makes it easy and create some agreements among neighbors, I mean, domestic dogs are dangerous animals when they get together. And so, for example, if you could get enough neighbors together and you could put fences around your homesteads instead of trying to get a contract grazer to come in with a bunch of fencing that they're going to spend all of their time trying to put up, you could create areas that were basically so easy to graze that they almost become ranches again. And we know some of these old property lines that were financially viable ranches for a long time. And we're not talking about set stocking a bunch of cattle on these places and overgrazing them the way they were doing in the 1867, which is the big drought that killed off a lot of grasses, was this big 1867 drought that nobody could sell because everybody was trying to sell it at the same time. There was no trucks. So we're not going to do that again. We're going to do it better. Once you get the fire safe councils together is the first step. Then you become this large entity that can interact and do things at a scale that isn't so expensive. Then you get a level of grazing that makes it so that the fires that move through don't have the same intensity, and so that your 100 feet around your house actually works. And then I think it's going to be just starting out really small with these prescribed fires. Starting out, you know, the volunteer fire departments are going to be some of the leaders in it. It's going to take some bold property owners to be sort of the risk takers in it. Not the risk takers as in not being prepared, but there's always going to be a level of liability in this. And we often, I think, kind of run the risk assessment in our brains in a really funny way. You know, okay, so there's a risk that this fire that I'm lighting on a cool, humid day in November could spread further than I planned, and yet, and still not hurt anyone, but I'm going to not do that, and then yet increase the risk that this really intense fire could come in the middle of July and burn the same place at an exponentially higher intensity. And then often you even hear the risk analysis of like, oh, but then if I bring the goats in, they might graze down my rose bush. You know, you really get into these kind of these risk analysis failures and if you can totally give up on the risk that the goat's going to graze your rose bush, then you can even get the price of contract grazing even lower, right? And we're going to have to do that here because the prices that they pay in Napa are not going to be the prices that we're going to pay here. We're going to have to figure out a way to deal with the inconvenience of doing it in a cheaper way.
And so what are some of the planned activities, or when are things going to start happening?
So there's a rancher down on the border between Mendocino and Sonoma County who is a bold guy, and he really wants people to see it. Because I think one of the things that happens is that we only see fire when it's really intense. That's when we see it in the news, right? And yet a really creepy, smoldery fire climbing down a hill is a very, very different thing. And a lot of us don't even get to see campfires that often anymore, right? So he's actually, and it'll progress, and it'll depend on what the weather is like on the day that this is planned. And that's one of the big challenges, is the more you plan it, really the more risky it becomes in a way, because you start being locked into a day that may or may not be the best day to burn. But in some cases, that's the way we're going to have to do it, is if we're going to get a lot of people there. I mean, I don't totally know what he has in mind yet, but I'm picturing stadium seats, you know?
When is this going to happen? I mean, tell us a little bit more specifically about it.
So on Magruder Ranch, our goal is 2 inches of rain. So that's when we start thinking about burning, is when it's been 2 inches, when we've seen 2 inches of rain fall. And I'm not sure what his opinion is and what his perspective is and what the fuel load is and what the topography is. But it depends on the rain year. It'll be after 2 inches of rain, and then the planning, and then the date will be set. But if you had a 2014 and it wasn't raining until January, then it won't happen. You have to have a level of moisture back into the plants and back into the soil before it becomes safe to start thinking about lighting fires.
About how big is this prescribed fire, do you think, just guessing, going to be? And who can go? Is this just for volunteer firefighters and burn bosses?
No, this is going to be open to the public. You know, if you're downhill from a fire, and the people who are trained and wearing the right PPE will still be downhill from the fire, but you won't be lighting a fire if you came. But there are always safe places to be. There's a road, you know, all the way around this piece that he's looking at burning. And I don't know, I think it was 100 acres or something. And, you know, might not burn the whole thing, probably won't burn the whole thing. I think the more you can only burn part of something, the more you can understand its effect. So the more we can have these really small things that happen, the more you get to listen to it afterwards. And then the Hugh Stafford is also now has a grant to be following around CAL FIRE, because CAL FIRE is picking up burning again. And they're going to be doing different things. They're going to be doing sometimes the more dangerous situations. You know, they're creating these disconnections between the urban areas and the forest in many ways to protect us from the forest and the forest from us. I think we have to think about it from both perspectives. You know, and sometimes it's kind of funny when you're burning chaparral, for example, if you can create a small burn, you can protect the chaparral from a burn. We don't want to burn all the chaparral. That's something that I actually learned recently. I thought that all of this chaparral kind of wanted to burn pretty frequently, but no, we want old growth chaparral. We want 100-year-old chaparral. And if we do have these return burns that come faster than the chaparral can set seed, we could start losing even our chaparral. And then you're talking about desertified hilltops and you're talking about erosion. So, and that's what they're seeing in Southern California, is these fire return intervals happening so fast that they can't. Humans are the same way. We can take stress. We love stress in a certain way. We just can't always be stressed, you know? And so I think we need to start. I find ecology to be a wonderful sort of therapy, because it responds in many of the same ways that we do. And it has many of the same challenges that we have. So this sort of constant stress, as opposed to punctuated stress, is something that fire ecologies need, just like people need.
Kyle Farmer, thank you very much. Yeah.